Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Confrontation Clause and Suspected Child Abuse Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 18, 2015, the Supreme Court decided Ohio v. Clark. This case involved two questions regarding the Sixth Amendment's Confrontation Clause. One, whether an individual's obligation to report suspected child abuse makes the individual an agent of law enforcement for purposes of the Confrontation Clause. And two, whether a child's out-of-court statements to a teacher in response to the teacher's concerns about potential child abuse qualify as testimonial statements subject to the Confrontation Clause. The Supreme Court of Ohio rejected Clark's challenge to his conviction on these grounds. The United States Supreme Court reversed the judgment of the Supreme Court of Ohio by a vote of 9-0 and remanded the case. In an opinion delivered by Justice Alito and joined by the Chief Justice and Justices Breyer, Kennedy, Sotomayor, and Kagan, the court held that because neither the child nor his teachers had the primary purpose of assisting in Clark's prosecution, the child's statements did not implicate the Confrontation Clause and therefore were admissible at trial. Justice Scalia, joined by Justice Ginsburg, filed an opinion concurring in the judgment. Justice Thomas also filed an opinion concurring in the judgment. To discuss the case, we have Professor Michael O'Shea, who is a professor of law at the Oklahoma City University School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor O'Shea.
On June 18, 2015, the Supreme Court decided the case of Ohio v. Clark, which asked whether the Sixth Amendment's Confrontation Clause was violated when prosecutors introduced at trial a 3-year-old abuse victim's out-of-court statements that identified his mother's live-in boyfriend as his abuser. The victim, LP, showed up at school with visible injuries. He was questioned by his classroom teachers and identified Clark as the person who harmed him, eventually leading to prosecution of Clark for felonious assault and other offenses. While LP was deemed incompetent to testify at trial under Ohio law, another provision of Ohio evidence law allowed the admission at trial of his hearsay statements to his teachers, identifying Clark as his abuser. The U.S. Supreme Court unanimously held that Clark's Confrontation Clause rights were not violated by admission of LP's statements. While recent Confrontation Clause cases have tended to produce splintered and closely divided courts, Clark yielded a majority opinion joined in full by six justices. The outcome in Clark was not surprising, and it's notable that the entire court stuck to the basic features of the current Confrontation Clause framework, which was launched by the landmark 2004 decision in Crawford v. Washington. Crawford, beginning with strong majority support from the justices, has in more recent years seemed to become more controversial, and several justices have signaled that they would be open to reconsidering Crawford. In Clark, however, the court sticks with that framework. But at the same time, several aspects of Clark suggest that a majority of the court, and thus the lower courts, are likely to take a relatively narrow view of the Crawford framework going forward. So the opinion of the court in Clark was authored by Justice Alito and was joined by Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Kennedy, Justice Breyer, Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Kagan. Applying the Crawford framework, which requires courts to decide whether hearsay statements are testimonial in nature. Testimonial statements can implicate the Confrontation Clause's protections, while non-testimonial statements do not. The court has, in past cases involving official interrogation, used what's called the primary purpose test. As traditionally understood, that test holds that to determine whether or not a statement produced by interrogation is testimonial, courts have to ask whether the primary purpose of the statement was assisting in prosecution or establishing facts for use in a future criminal investigation and prosecution. The court has said more recently that in determining that, whether the primary purpose of a statement, courts should look not only to the likely intentions and purposes of the declarant, the out-of-court speaker whose statement is being used, but also to the interrogator. Applying that test in this case, the court concluded that under all the circumstances, LP statements were not made with the primary purpose of assisting in Clark's prosecution, and his teachers likewise lacked that as their primary purpose. The court emphasized LP's very young age, he was only 3, and said more generally that statements by very young children are quite unlikely to implicate the Confrontation Clause because they normally lack a sufficient understanding of the law enforcement and prosecutorial system. Furthermore, the court said the teacher's primary purpose was to inquire after LP's safety and protect him from possible injury, not to set up an investigation or prosecution of his abuser. This was so, the court held, even though Ohio law, like the law of many other states, makes elementary and secondary school teachers mandatory reporters who have a legal obligation to refer evidence of abuse or statements indicating abuse to the proper authorities. One threshold issue in the case was whether statements made to persons who are not law enforcement officials can ever yield testimonial statements under Crawford, and there was some thinking that the court might be able to put together a majority that would actually hold that only statements made to government officials can be testimonial under Crawford, and thus only those types of statements can implicate the Confrontation Clause. The court in Clark wisely, I think, rejected that categorical rule and indicated that some statements to non-law enforcement may implicate the Confrontation Clause. This seems clearly correct. Consider the example of volunteered testimony, such as a person who writes out a notarized affidavit accusing a neighbor in detail of various serious crimes and then leaves that affidavit with another neighbor before skipping town. This seems clearly to be a statement whose primary purpose was to create a substitute for trial testimony, though it was not delivered to or made to a government official. Although the court stuck to Crawford, the primary purpose test of Crawford and its progeny, the test may have undergone some narrowing in the Clark court's application. Justice Alito's opinion seemed to emphasize some of the narrower formulations of the necessary purpose, especially the formulation that says, to be testimonial, a statement must have the primary purpose of creating an out-of-court substitute for trial testimony. And the court emphasized that the teacher's mandatory reporter status could not convert that conversation into one generating testimonial statements. In fact, the court said it was irrelevant that the teacher's questions and answers clearly tended to implicate and set up a prosecution of the abuser that the child identified. This decision is likely to be seen as a green light in many respects for states to continue to impose reporting requirements and generate statements from alleged abuse victims that are admissible at trial without implicating the Confrontation Clause through the mechanism of having the statements taken by non-law enforcement individuals subject to reporting requirements. Justice Antonin Scalia concurred in the judgment in Clark, joined by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. In Justice Scalia's view, the court simply should have held that LP's statements were not testimonial because his young age made clear that he couldn't form the primary purpose of intending to create a substitute for trial testimony or to perpetuate facts for use in a criminal prosecution. Justice Scalia deplored the court's decision to range further with its opinion, and many commentators have noted the strikingly personal tone of Justice Scalia's separate opinion. There are some passages that seemed designed to suggest that the majority opinion was motivated by hostility to the Crawford decision and the relatively defendant-protective regime it seemed to create. Justice Scalia made reference to the comparative popularity of Crawford's predecessor, the old regime of Ohio v. Roberts, with prosecutors and former prosecutors, which many have read as a pointed reference to Justice Alito, the majority author. Some commentators have found it odd to juxtapose the indignant reaction in the concurrence with the relatively understated tone of the Clark opinion, which adheres to the Crawford framework in broad form and relinquished the opportunity to cut back on it in categorical form, such as saying only statements to law enforcement can be testimonial. My theory about this, and it involves a considerable amount of speculation, but is worth considering, I think. Some of the sharp tone of Justice Scalia's separate writing in Clark may also stem from his reaction to the court's last major Confrontation Clause case, Williams versus Illinois, a very splintered decision that was issued in 2012. Justice Scalia did not write separately in Williams. He joined Justice Kagan's eloquent dissent, but compared to the relatively understated surface of the Clark opinion, Justice Alito's plurality opinion in Williams also sought to take a narrow view of the Confrontation Clause, and there were some passages in there that could fairly be described as an intellectual strain. For example, at one point, the Alito plurality in Williams argued that a forensic lab report identifying a semen sample from a rape scene was non-testimonial because it was part of a response to an ongoing emergency, even though the sample was not even provided to the crime lab until 9 months after the crime and wasn't even returned to the police until several months later. I think Justice Scalia was not able to have his say in Williams because he let Justice Kagan write the dissent, and I think there is some of that frustration carrying over into the separate opinion in Clark. More generally, Justice Scalia is worried about another feature of the Clark opinion that suggests a narrowing of Crawford based on a very fact-intensive inquiry about what sorts of hearsay statements were admissible at common law at the time of the framing. There is a passage in the majority opinion in Clark where the court says that neither Crawford nor any of the cases it has produced has mounted evidence that the adoption of the Confrontation Clause was understood to require the exclusion of evidence that was regularly admitted in criminal cases at the time of the founding. At first blush, that might seem like an unexceptional statement. Crawford itself is famously immersed in the founding era history of the Confrontation Clause. But I think Justice Scalia is worried that the historical inquiry may take on a more and more pronounced role in future Confrontation Clause cases, down to the individual level of requiring a defendant to show that there's a historical analog for his particular kind of the particular kind of hearsay statement against him being inadmissible at the time of the founding. And over against that, many viewed Crawford as an effort precisely to detach the confrontation guarantee from the vagaries of hearsay law, to put it on a more textually grounded basis by saying the confrontation clause doesn't refer to hearsay, it refers to the witnesses against the accused. And Crawford is profitably read as saying we should ask what function a witness against an accused serves, and when a hearsay declarant makes that kind of statement or makes it with that kind of intent, that should normally implicate the Confrontation Clause's protections unless there is very clear grounds for making an exception. And Justice Scalia does admit historically grounded exceptions in the case of dying declarations and forfeiture by wrongdoing. So the relevance of historical practice to the scope of the guarantee, that itself is common ground, but I think there's a very sharp difference between Justices Scalia and Ginsburg and a majority of the court as to how much deference should be given to the broader, more rule-like Crawford formulations versus an inquiry into founding-era hearsay practices. And I think Justice Scalia's commitment to formalism, the idea that both liberty and the rule of law are served by adherence to relatively clear and predictable legal categories, is really driving a lot of his unease with the course of the court's recent Crawford decision. One of the principal flaws he found in the court's pre-Crawford jurisprudence was its excessive malleability. And I think Justice Scalia now worries that the court's recent trend of A, widening the totality of relevant circumstances for the primary purpose test, and now B, possibly encrusting that test with a large number of historically based exceptions, risks reducing Crawford's test to a state of what Justice Scalia sees as jurisprudential degradation, little better than the abandoned decision in Ohio v. Roberts.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.